Welcome back to the Media Corps Minute Podcast. Today we have an incredible guest, Paul Ahrens. Paul is a business and executive coach, a CEO, and an entrepreneur with over 40 years of experience in building, buying, and scaling businesses. He's the founder of the Fit Professional One, where he helps business leaders execute at a high level, get their teams truly productive, and scale efficiently, all while avoiding burnout. He's also the author of Funding Your Future Beyond Banks, where he shares creative strategies for growing businesses the right way. Well, Paul, I wanted to, again, thank you for joining me today. You know, this is exciting. We're in the new space. This is the first episode where we actually did the remodel, so we're excited to have you on and kick it off. And, but yeah, how's everything going today? How you doing?
Really good. Thanks for having me. Congratulations on your new space.
Appreciate that.
Feel like pretty special right here. I encourage the next guest to get their butts here and enjoy.
So, that's right. That's
great job. Very professional. I'm doing good. It's good to be here. I love to talk about business.
Absolutely.
Well, so anytime somebody says, hey, let's talk about business, I'll drive to do that because it's my passion.
Absolutely.
It's good to be here.
Well, I'm excited to get into it. You know, I definitely like to, you know, get into people's background. But before we even get into that, I know obviously you have a lot of, you know, experience in business and leadership and coaching. But for those that don't know who you are, you know, what kind of stuff are you doing today?
Today, what I'm doing is a big project is transitioning a fourth generation business.
Yep.
And that's going very well. We could talk about that if you wanted. However, it's a great place to coach. It's like a coaching lab.
Yeah.
And to an extent, it's kind of nice because they're also employees. So if I screw up,
right,
there's time to maybe rectify things, but it's going very well. And I literally do zero on a day-to-day basis.
Wow.
So the transition is going very well. And it's not just family. It's fourth generation family.
Okay.
We're in our 108th year as of May 1.
Wow.
It's a long time.
And congrats to that. That's
yes,
great.
Yes. And a big key to that is the non-family managers, which I want to do a shout out to. I mean, you need a good team, and I'm really excited about this team. So I'm doing that. Plus, the other things I'm doing is my Fit Professional One business.
Yep.
And you can pop that website up, but that's great fun. And what I try to do there is really focus on maybe younger professionals, really any professional. But I don't know everything, but what I do know, it's just really frustrating for me to see young professionals make mistakes, go through the same thing I did. Yep. I would have killed for some kind of mentor.
Yeah, absolutely.
Back then. And but it's more than that. It's, you know, that is a product where you say X dollars, I'm essentially on call or we talk about your issues. But I'm also working on and really excited about rolling out a plethora of products, a suite of products that are graduated in nature. So you don't have to spend thousands to get in. You can find a specific issue you need help on, and then you jump into that. And as you go, if you get stuck, there's more and more and more and more. So I'm really excited about that. And so that's what I'm working on. Plan to roll that out under a new website. Hopefully by July.
Yeah.
There's a lot of work to do.
And all under that branding of the Fit Professional One, right?
Yes.
And, you know, who do you coach in that? What kind of businesses? What kind of leaders?
It's been kind of all over the board. There's been property owners. There's been construction companies. There's been lawyers.
It's not industry specific necessarily, is it? Some maybe?
Yes. You know, that's one thing. A jack of all trades is a master of none, right? But there are fundamental business issues that just go to every business, and I end up being able to help there. My actual expertise where I can do a super deep dive is logistics, fleet management, mining, non-metallic, aggregate processing, civil construction, civil design, those kind of things I've done quite a bit with over time. And then in the water industry and
Well, I know we're going to get into it, you know, more, but, You know, just kind of curious, you know, what are some of the big challenges that businesses you think are facing just right now?
That, I love that question. And, oh boy, we could talk for hours on this. One that fascinates me right now, and I know most professionals have a presence on LinkedIn.
Yeah.
And it is a great way to get your word out and such. So I've just been watching what comes across on LinkedIn. And what seems to be happening is a plethora of advice on, you know, 7 ways to be a better manager. Here's 5 attributes of a good manager, bad manager, good leader, bad leader. And what seems to be lacking, so I think it's an issue, is what about just a good professional in their role?
Yeah.
One of the podcasts I did way back, I had a Marine and a Naval Corpsman on, and they talked about how significant their role was and how they brought honor and dignity and character and hard work and effort, understood what that is, and knocked it out of the park.
Yeah.
There seems to be a lot of people looking for shortcuts, and I don't mean to be pessimistic necessarily either.
Yeah.
But I think young professionals, people at any level, if they really focus on their role, they can not only improve their careers, but certainly make it better for what their organization is. So that's one, is like this, everybody's a leader can be problematic.
Yep. Yep.
The other one that is kind of a corollary to that, that I think is interesting, is alignment.
Yeah.
And okay, so the Eagles just kicked butt, won a convincing Super Bowl, just this past weekend.
Oh, yeah.
And one thing we know about the Eagles organization, they're probably out partying and having a good time, right? Justifiably so, celebrating, doing those kind of things. But what we know is they all want to win a Super Bowl, and they want to win it every year, top to bottom.
Yep.
The people cleaning their floors, filling their coffee machines, doing their laundry to the, all the stars.
Yeah.
Top to bottom, they have this alignment. And in organizations, I think it's hard to get that.
Mm-hmm.
On one end of the pole, you have a very transactional worker who's there for a paycheck.
Right.
And then on the other end, we have people that will literally work for no money because they love what they're doing.
Yeah.
And there's this span. And if you can get people aligned, that is a powerful organization. I think it's harder and harder to do as people look a little bit more at me.
Yep, yep, absolutely.
As opposed to the organization.
Right.
And, the way to kind of summarize those two particular things is just think about having an organization of the willing.
Right.
Right?
Yep.
I mean, that's what we want.
Yep.
And I think that's – it's frustrating for the employees too, because – it is management and leadership's responsibility to make it clear where they're going and what they're doing, but also be consistent there and not just change 180 degrees.
Jumping all over.
Yep. People really have to know what they're getting into when they take a job. But those are two.
Yeah, those are great.
Yeah.
The alignment is actually going to come up later too.
Okay, good.
So I'm excited to dive into some of that and like the work-life balance. Mm-hmm. But kind of going into, obviously, your background, like, tell me a little bit about, obviously, growing up, and then also, like, when you started figuring out that, hey, I have an entrepreneur spirit,
Yeah, that I love the question. I've thought about that a lot, and for me, I was a kid, just a regular Midwestern kid. Mm-hmm. I had a lot of faith and trust in the people that were senior to me, mom, dad, managers, coaches, teachers.
Yep.
And maybe it was that era, going through high school in the 1970s.
Yep.
Go look up an episode of Happy Days, right? I'm more like Richie Cunningham. I just trusted, not that I was all on the straight and narrow, but that really shaped me. And what happened was, is when I would listen and have faith in the advice and then try it, there would be a result. Sometimes I'd screw up and learn. Sometimes I'd get it right. But that started to mold me that if I do A, then I can make B happen, or I can influence B, or I can create B. And that's, I think the entrepreneur spirit really hit me quite early. even in high school, I'm like, what do I want to be? And I wanted, I was good at math, good at science. I wanted to be an engineer. But what type of engineer? So I picked industrial engineering because it was just so broad of a background, so I could figure out what I wanted to do. But I wanted to create. I wanted to manage. Be a boss isn't quite right, but I wanted to create organizations that really got something done for customers. The whole idea, you know, I've heard the cliche, right? Buy low, sell high.
Yeah.
It fascinates me to this day. I mean, we're talking into these awesome microphones. Somebody's making this thing and making money with it. And then you're getting the value of putting together a podcast, and it you know, that's utility. How do you really put a number on the microphone itself? It's part of a, you know, I'll stop. It's not that great of an example, but that fascinated me and really made me want to try things and get to a point where I had an organization that I could make some of the calls.
I mean, did you go into that kind of knowing that you wanted to be a part of kind of the family business that you guys had going on?
No, not at all, actually. Okay. In fact, I didn't want to work at the family business because the family business was a closed shop, meaning it was unions. There was three unions there, and my dad was kind of a retired chairman, if you will. So he was employed, but he wasn't a day-to-day guy. And when I was coming through high school and college, I never got any real work.
Yeah.
And, you know, why can't I drive a truck? Why can't I be on a grading crew? I finally got to work in the materials lab, which was good. I appreciate that. But I ended up between my senior and our junior and senior in college finally realizing that I got to go get, you know, a different job on my own. So I went and got my own engineering internship, and I just vowed at that time, I'm not working for the family business. And not so much, but I didn't understand it.
Yeah.
I really didn't. I mean, we had the family discussions, but my industrial engineering degree, I knew it would be applicable. But at the time, I went to Purdue University, a great university, and we were highly recruited by companies like Eli Lilly and IBM and 3M and Bain & Olufsen and all these kind of cool companies. And I ended up getting an offer at IBM, so I took off and went there.
Okay.
And
so how long did you do that before you started transitioning?
Yeah, I worked there 4 years, and my dad kept pecking at me, right? He would call up and say, hey, you know, we have this new division in these machines. We need to coordinate it. You know, you'll get to call all the shots, blah, blah, blah. And my wife accepted the job 2 years before I did. And seriously, she, bless her heart, she says, I'm going back to Eau Claire. Are you?
Yeah.
And so,
you coming with?
Yeah, she really wanted to get back, and I have no regrets. You know, I learned a lot at IBM, but I was a fish out of water there, so to speak. A lot of super talented people right out of college, and they were profoundly patient with their young professionals. Taught us a lot.
Yeah.
But so I ended up after 4 years coming back to the family business.
Do you think it is helpful for people? You know, we've even here on the podcast, we've had so many multi-generational family-owned businesses. You know, is it helpful for, you know, kids to go out and do something different first before joining the family business, in your mind?
Yeah, in fact, now with me being the owner, we have we call it a family constitution, where we require kids to go out and work preferably at least 5 years somewhere else before they come into the family business.
Right.
And so I have two kids working at the business, and both of them had jobs elsewhere. They went out and got on their own and were successful with before they petitioned to get back. And mostly they wanted to get back to the Eau Claire, Wisconsin, and Rochester. You know, it's just a great part of the country through here. Those of us that live here know.
Oh, yeah.
It's why we really stick
through the cold, you know.
Yeah, if you can get by with a little bit of cold, it's really, really nice.
Yeah,
but yeah, so I think that's very important to go work somewhere else.
Yeah, it's kind of what I've seen a lot of times. You're going in with a different mindset, I feel like, a lot of times. But
there's an issue of nepotism, right? With the family gets everything. Well, the truth is, usually in successful family businesses, the families they're managed pretty hard. You know, they have to work pretty darn hard. And it's very important to just not make work when you have non-family managers that, and employees that are kicking butt, to bring somebody in who's actually qualified for the role.
Right.
And have we been perfect on that? No. But we really try to get there quick. So I think that's kind of a little bit of the rest of the story.
So was there any businesses that you've been a part of between, obviously, the family business and the Fit Professional now, that you've been a part of, bought or sold or anything like that?
Oh, yeah. There's quite a few.
Yeah.
So when I bought out the family business, I did essentially what's called a roll-up, a bunch of smaller mergers and acquisitions in a geography. And so I really count each one of those. It was a total of 9 that we rolled in. I'd say 4 of them were pretty hefty numbers of employees, which is like entering a new company. And the whole thing with culture, work ethic, procedures, all the things that you have to do to make that work.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of count every one of those. I also try my hand, worst time ever, 2007, 2008 at real estate, and those I can chalk up to some failures, but I learned a ton.
Yeah.
I had some fun doing it. I'd like to not have done it right when real estate was tanking.
Yep.
That the only kind of solace is I wasn't the only one that what was there then, but those businesses, I started, ran for a while and stopped, actually executed what I call stop loss. It's a business school term, depending on what business school you studied at, where you try something. If you can't get it profitable around 24 months or have a good reason why it's not, why are you doing it?
And, interesting.
And those I ran a couple of them a little bit longer, but finally pulled the plug.
Yeah.
And learned a ton along the way. And I'm good at hedging my bets. I always had other things to fall back on.
Well, that's interesting. And, obviously doing anything like that, you're going to learn a significant amount. Just going through the process, succeeding and failing, on both ends of just – it's a huge learning experience.
Mm-hmm.
And you've also written some books, is that correct?
Well, I finished one.
Okay.
And I'm working on 3 more.
I like it.
So the one book that's done is called Beyond Banks, or Funding Your Future Beyond Banks. And it's really written for anybody trying to get a project funded and approved.
Okay.
And so it applies to entrepreneurs, but it also applies to people that might be in a corporate spot.
Right.
Especially young professionals come out of school with great ideas and they want to get stuff done. Well, how do I do that?
Yep.
And that is the audience I wrote it for. I'm really doing these books kind of as part of my transition to encapsulate some genres, some major areas of things that I know. So they're captured for my management team too. And in this particular one, the appendix is actually 19 steps to get a bank loan, and and the rest has some creative ways that I funded acquisitions, or I funded different parts of my business or major plant builds without anybody's financing. Kind of using the business, working with vendors, working with customers to get things done, and I think there's lessons in there for everybody. The other books, I'm working on one that is, I won't call it a philosophy book, but I call it the Intensity Multiplier Principles. Mm. I'm not going to go way into it, but there's 18, I'm an engineer, right?
Yeah.
So I really like to look at cause and effect relationships. So I have 18 very recognizable, really kind of life and professional attributes that I think work in pairs, where they mate. If you work on one, you multiply the other one, thus the multiplying. And then when you work on combinations of the 18, they work. So I'm working on that one. I've been working on it quite long.
Yeah.
Another book I'm working on is called Discretionary Time Management. And that's really going to be a big part of my flagship in my product offering too, on executing through people. And that one is...
Call that the DTM, right?
Yeah, DTM.
Yep. So, I want to chat about that too later.
And that one I'm really excited about. It's kind of soup to nuts to get employees aligned, make sure people understand how they contribute to the success of the organization. Mm-hmm. And it's patterned after really smart people like Porter and Kaplan at the Harvard Business School, but filling in all their kind of holes, at least in my reality. And I'm excited to get that out there and share it. And really excited about that. And also some product offerings around it too.
Well, that's very exciting.
And the last one is kind of a fun one. And I don't know what I'm going to call it yet, but it has to do with this leadership thing. And right now, I mean, I toy with the, you know, you can bleep me if you have to, but modern leadership is bullshit. And what I mean by leadership is not, but the way the word leadership has been watered down, retooled, redefined, I think it needs to be pulled back to where it is. And I've had the pleasure of a lot of input from some of it's on my podcast. Others are just professional relationships with leaders that I've kind of coalesced what leadership really is. It's a little bit more old school than kind of the everybody's a leader thing.
Right.
But I hope to have some fun with it and raise some eyebrows.
That's exciting. So, yeah. I like it. No, that's exciting too. And I still got to – I got to get that first book. Mm-hmm. Is that on your website?
I should have brought it. Yeah, it's on. You can get it on my website. Okay. It's on Amazon. It's also on Audible if you want to listen to it.
I'm an Audible
there.
Guy.
Yeah. Yeah, I love listening to Audible in the right mode. Like on the way over here, you focus, you know, go at 1.5x. You can just kick through them. But yeah.
Yep.
It's hardcover paperback on Amazon, and then it's on my website too. Amazon, it's frankly priced a little better, so I go there.
Go to Amazon then.
Yeah.
Well, I know I want to kind of move segue into segue here.
Sure.
Know? And, you know, you've developed your own framework you call Segue to help businesses execute and grow. But want to just first have you kind of just break that down. Give me the overview of that.
So I'll start real high level. Segue is just easy to listen to or to pronounce and remember. And really, I'm... for lack of a better word, kind of force-fitting my experience into six silos of products so they can be organized. And so it's strategy, execution, growth, think business development, well-being for the W, alignment for the A, and then year over year, which I use for the Y, and that's has more to do with just really doing a deep dive on levers of control are actual KPIs that actually work. So, you know, we have all these things, OCRs, KPIs, levers of control. You know, how do you really make it work and what is that all about? But I'm really going to start out with the E part, the execution, and that's along the discretionary time management product mix. What I will have out when my website's updated is I'll have no charge checklists, which are really quite good. If you want to do the work, you, for instance, in the strategy section, I have 14 checklists. They're all done in rough. I think I have six or eight of them already ready for publishing. Those are giveaways for give me your email. And then the next piece, which I'll have a nominal charge for, is the worksheet that goes with them.
Right.
Okay, and the worksheet has to do with people that haven't really spent a lot of time maybe in the whole genre of strategy or in the particular part they're looking at.
Yeah.
Okay, and then from there, what I'll do is I'll bundle those into master's classes, if you will. There'll be classes with some casework, and then I'll bundle that one more time into a part-day seminar. Okay. And so that follows for each one of these groups. Yeah. And I'm going to try to roll out about one per quarter. And again, what really is a huge motivation to me, I love to work with other people and sell this stuff, right?
Yeah.
But it is a great roadmap for the transition of the business, too. And so I have that benefit. It's like a massive training module for people to start and run businesses.
Right.
So I'm really excited about it.
Well, as you know, obviously, you doing it, learning it, and going through it gives you a lot of that information and the tools to now teach others.
Yep.
But no, you hit a little on the E. I did want to kind of focus on like those first three a little bit.
Sure.
And just some questions around that. So strategy specifically, you know, what do you think that a lot of businesses get wrong when it comes to just the strategy portion?
Strategy has to, okay, so a strategy, that's another word that has been defined so many times. Mm-hmm. And so it becomes difficult because people go, okay, I'm going to do strategy. So they're going to go look something up and they're, okay, so I'm going to do this and that and the other thing. And then they're done and they think they have a strategy.
Yeah.
Well, ultimately, to answer your question, one of the basic things is strategy has to be quantified and it has to be communicated. Mm. And you have to be able to tie it back to what people do in a day to actually make this strategy happen.
Right.
So one of the checklists and one of the courseworks I'll have is how to do a strategy map. Mm-hmm. And a strategy map is really, right, most of us are for-profit businesses, so the ultimate result is, well, you have your purpose and your profit. You have to have margin to, that's the ultimate sustainability plan is you got to have margin. But how does that work down to each individual employee?
Right.
That whole thing I call discretionary time management because you have to link strategy to what people do in a day. And that's really hard work. Mm. It's really hard work. So strategy in and of itself really has to do with, and I'm not going to go through all the, you know, Reed Porter, Reed Kaplan, they're unbelievable books. If people would ever contact you and want my reading list of strategy books, I have about 25 of them I've gone through that I really think I use them for references. There's so much in there you can't carry it all with yourself. But everything from strategy maps to SWOT analysis to initiatives to how you get all that stuff going. But strategy, it's complex, but the strategy itself has to be simple. So think, what am I good at? What differentiates me?
Yeah.
And what are my resources? You have to take those into account.
Yep.
You know, like I could say, well, I want to be Elon Musk and make a competitor to SpaceX. Well, wait a minute. I have, you know, sand and gravel, and I have management know-how, and I have trucks and factories. And wait a minute, that doesn't look like rockets.
Right.
I mean, to make the point.
Yep.
So you really have to start there and go, okay, then what am I going to do differently for a customer? What will a customer pay for, and why will they pay for it? Mm. And then you have to go right through everything you do and figure out what that differentiator is that they pay you for. Mm-hmm. It's hard to, I don't feel like that's complete, but I'll stop there because it's something I encourage entrepreneurs and business owners to really think about. But customer and resources, start there. How are those aligned? And then what can I do to bring those together to make a margin?
Mm-hmm. Well, I was going to ask you like that, you know, if someone doesn't have a clear strategy, what would you tell them that very first step, you know, is? Is it reading? Is it thinking about these different topics?
Do an inventory of what I just said. What resources do I have in terms of maybe it's trucks, factories, buildings, vehicles, computers, know-how? Mm-hmm. Take a look at maybe I have a customer already and I'm trying to expand, or maybe I have a target customer. What do they want? What's their problem that I'm trying to solve?
Yep.
Very specifically, work hard to answer those questions and then start the business planning. Once you decide what your differentiator is and how you're going to deliver it to your customer, we could draw a line and say we've established strategy. Now everything's operational after that.
Yep.
So I would say work hard on understanding how what my bundle of know-how and resources is going to do for the customer. How am I going to do that? That's a good place to start.
Yeah.
It's way easier to say than to do.
Have you heard of a guy named Patrick Bet-David?
No.
He's a kind of a coach now, big sales guy, but he's, you know, doing podcasts and stuff like that too. And I think it's relevant to this because, you know, as you're talking about these things, you know, I'm thinking about the internet and YouTube and podcasts and how much information is just out there, and it's constantly being pushed out. And I feel like you really got to be, you know, careful to like make sure who you're listening to, it's actually good information, because there is a lot of noise out there. And that was one thing that he was talking about recently, was like how much just content and information this year over any other year will just be so heavily pushed.
Yeah.
And how people need to be careful, like, who are you learning from? Yeah,
yep, and that's one reason I like my checklist approach, because they can do a deep dive on one checklist item.
Yep.
And so some cautions that I would just share that I've run into is, we'll have celebrity type, hundreds of millions of net worth, very famous people who had some kind of brand issue, but never really did the work, and they're out hawking strategy.
Mm-hmm.
I'd just be really careful right there.
Yep.
We also have nothing against corporate types. I was at IBM, didn't get that far at all up the totem pole there. But people that haven't pushed their own money into the center of the table are also those in some shape, manner, or form.
Right.
Are also those that I would watch. Like, you can go out and become a certified coach.
Yeah. Hey.
Okay, I got a 4-year business degree from an undergrad school. Great, good job. And now I go become a certified coach. If you've raised, you know, $1 million in capital, do you want to talk to that person? And there's some really good certified coaches, because they learn as they go, by the way.
Yep.
But I'm just as cautions, I would find somebody who's walked part of the track that you've walked.
Yep.
You know, as checklist to kind of ferret through all the content. And I would be aware of the checklist. I recently did a blog, I think it's my last blog that I published. Try taking the contrarian view to all these quick fix checklists content. What I love about management and people is we can find exceptions to almost everything we say. That's the beauty. That's where the art comes in. And it's super good for your learning to, like, say, okay, I'm going to take the opposite viewpoint. When would the opposite be applicable and useful? It's really, really a good thing to do. And I think the better content generators will add that kind of detail.
Mm-hmm.
At least that's been my
experience. That's good. No, I like that. Yeah, even the coaching, I feel like, has gotten very popular too these days. And, you know, I mean, you're right in saying it. It's like, you know, you see a lot of coaches coaching a topic where they've never seen necessarily success in it before, but they're ready to tell you what it takes to do that. You know, I see in a lot of industries, even specifically our industry, you know, we help out some people, you know, you could call it coaching on the side. But it's like, that's not my main focus. Like, this is my main focus, but They're only reaching out for, you know, quote unquote coaching, because they've seen us do it, and they're like, how are you doing that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there's too many people that haven't done it that are just like, I'll show you how, and it's like, what are you talking about?
Yeah,
but so I like that.
Yeah, my experience has been with coaches that there's a whole bunch out there, and frankly, there could be more. Frankly, yeah. And I heard an analogy from one author that said, coaching is like, I'm not a fisherman, but apparently you got to keep your fly on the water. The people that catch the most fish have their fly on the water the longest.
Mm.
And there's a couple lessons in there, I think, for both the consumer of coaching and those of us trying to be coaches that I'm trying to aspire to, is we only can do so much.
Yeah.
So what we have to do is let the world know what we can do in terms of something like my Segway product list.
Yep.
And then people will actually come and utilize your services or your products when they have a real problem.
Yeah.
Otherwise, trying to force it just doesn't work.
Right. Like, right.
You know, but
no, I like it. And, you know, getting into kind of that transition from the strategy into the execution piece, like, where do you, or why do so many businesses struggle to kind of take their initial strategy, because, you know, I mean, you mentioned like you have to do that right, but then turn it into actually something that they're executing on currently in their business.
I learned this the first time it was presented to me in an industrial engineering class a million years ago, and it's who's going to do what when with what with what expected result for how much. Mm. And you could add where in there too. Mm-hmm. That simple but very it's also very complex is typically not answered in a way that everybody really understands their roles. I think that's the and then there's that alignment thing we talked about before. If do you have a company of the willing? You know, we're turning left. Do you have a bunch of people that want to go right? Yeah, you know, was it Jack Welch or one of the business authors of the last 20 years talked about, are you on the bus?
Yeah, the right seat.
On the bus in the right seat.
Yeah.
I think that's where it starts. And we all know it, but it's really hard to implement in practice.
Right.
It's much more difficult.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that you even hear, but it's like, well, a lot of times it's not, well, the how. Well, how do I actually, you know, do those things? But I like the willingness of the team. I mean,
yeah.
that's a huge piece. Top-down leadership, you know, we're bringing a new initiative or something like that, and nobody's jumping on board with it. That's not helping anyone.
How is a really good one? I mean, in the old days, they made us figure it out.
Yeah.
Figure it out. So in the long question, who does what, where, when, you can add how with what. We're actually hired as employees to do the how.
Mm.
And so that's a frustration and a chance both to the employee and the employer is that you need training to be functional, but you also are paid to answer the how on a day-to-day basis depending on what your job is.
Right.
And as that's accumulated, I think companies don't capture that. We call that experience, and it leaves when someone retires or change jobs. So the way to capture that is to just have living training modules that can be really, really easy. You can pop up Microsoft PowerPoint. You can do screenshots, videos, insert pictures, do recordings, all kinds of stuff. Mm. And you just have people, they also double as procedures. And then the next person comes into the role, they have that, and then they update it. And it's very difficult to get that going, but I would highly recommend it for people to tackle that question of how. It's a really astute thing to say.
Mm.
And I think it was a good comment in one of our major challenges in business.
Something that you said kind of actually gets into my next question too, where a lot of leaders take too much on themselves instead of empowering their teams. You know, why do you think that happens so often? I mean, I can even, you know, I feel that sometimes here too. It's like, well, I'll figure it out and then I'll tell you what to do instead of let you figure it out. You know, part of that how too.
Yes, we small businesses, it's really difficult because we can't afford training departments. And we have, I call it corporate pace. It's the pace put on us by our customers. It's deliverables and due dates. And they don't jive. You have an employee just like you described, and the extra time it's going to take you and the employee to train the employee, you just go, I'm just going to do it.
Yep.
And you end up in this circle of never quite getting out of that. And I think it takes a real commitment to very purposefully with intention to step out of that as the department manager or business owner, whatever your role is, and get back to defining people's roles. Who's going to do what, when, how, with what expected result, by when?
Mm.
And that's the part we never get to because we're small businesses and the next job came in, right? We had to bid it. We had this weird guy named Paul who wants to pay us to set up his studio. You know, we have, because these guys did that for me. You can cut that out if you're not in that business. And thanks for the help. But you have all these things that happen, and then these deadlines land on you,
mm-hmm.
and we try to adjust, and we try not to get too far off of what we're doing, but sometimes we have to go take a look to see if it's going to fit in our business or if our reality has changed. Mm. And then there's that thing called change. And our planning cycle this time, on that note, we're going to try to make our employees change ready. What the hell does that mean?
And what does that mean? Yeah.
Yeah.
Change ready?
Yeah. So that means constantly updating your skill sets, trying to speculate on what the skill gap is 5 years from now. Really, really hard to do. And then when do they do that? Do they do that on their time or your time?
Right.
A team of the willing, I tell you what, that Eagles defensive line was out practicing steps and lifting extra weights and doing quick foot drills and, you know, swim drills and all the stuff they do a whole lot this year to win that game. And it wasn't at training camp.
Yep.
And I think that's what has to happen. You, a team of the willing, really aligned with what you do. You really do need your employees. Hey, you employees out there in small business, you really do need to take it upon yourself to add skill sets.
Yeah.
And you have a responsibility to stay current. The employees are going to do what they can, but we're so strapped.
Yeah.
Geez, you're driving a nice car and you redid your studio. We're probably depreciating that. You know, that was an investment. We got to get a payback and margin, blah, 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 blah. But I think that's a big part is the employees got to step up to that and be part of that solution, be willing to be part of that solution rather than waiting for management to constantly solve their problems.
Right, right.
Boy, companies that get that done, teams win championships.
Do you think it ever comes down to like just an information and an understanding gap between, you know, employee and employer? Because a lot of times there's obviously there's a lot of complexities to business, you know. We're very young into business still. We're only 6.5 years in, still learning a lot. But like, that's something that I have to go and drive and keep pushing for, and I'm learning it specifically. But then you have a team member that doesn't maybe, again, have that same knowledge and understanding of what all it takes to do these things and run a business and grow. But then they see what we charge for a video, and they see what the annual revenue is. But then, you know, then they don't see all the other stuff. So they see that. And then when it comes down to like, well, who should be doing what on whose time, you know, and that's where some of that disconnect I think comes and where we get pushback. Like, well, do you want me to do that here? Should I be training here? Or should I be doing that on my own time to get better so that I could progress inside of the company and, you know, get paid more too?
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that ever happens? I think, you know, for us, I feel like it does. I mean, that's...
Yeah, don't by my comments think that we're perfect. There's no way.
Yeah.
We aim at perfection and hopefully end up with excellence, right? That cliche. And none of my companies have ever done this perfectly. And the communication from the top has never been perfect. And there's always a gap, but you try and you try and you try. And boy, you can talk to people that have worked with and for and around me, and I'll have spans where they'll go, wow, that's really good communication. Then they'll go like, where's Paul been for 2 months? Serious.
Yeah, yeah.
And what they ultimately find out, I have one employee who's worked for us over 40 years, and it's really, really cool.
That's wild.
Super healthy, super productive, pace setter, culture keeper, just super employee. And that employee has seen enough come and go where that particular person has what I had when I was young. And they have a certain faith in management that they're trying to do the right thing and get things going. Because that shortcoming ultimately has to be filled in with faith rather than constant questioning until they catch up. And then as managers and leaders, we got to make sure that we're trying to fill that communication void appropriately. You know, not everybody needs to know everything.
I was just going to ask
that. And that's really hard on people because people want to know everything.
Yeah.
And that's where that trust and faith and alignment comes in, right? Yeah. Let's go back to the sports analogy in the Philadelphia Eagles. So the defensive line that I thought was the whole game changer from this fan's point of view, that defensive line is not privy to what their quarterback and back were dreaming up. You know, unless they're the occasional two-way starter in the NFL, well, how many years has that been? It's been a decade or something. I mean, see what I mean? But they trust that it's happening in that department, and then they come together to – I don't think businesses are that much different, although we tend to have a little bit more crossover, especially in small business, lots of hats.
Yeah,
a lot of hats. But you can't communicate too much with the direction and role. And then you have to make decisions on just getting to the point where I'm not going to communicate anymore because we actually have to do something today. Mm-hmm. And then you're a good guy and a good manager, and maybe you made a mistake and you realize that you should have shared something with someone. So then you make it up and you go talk to them. And so the thing is that entrepreneurs, company owners, managers, department heads, project leads, they're people too.
Yeah.
And they're going to screw up. And that's why I'm back to, if everybody will really focus on their role, they can really make a huge, huge difference. And one quick story from the Marine that was on a podcast that I did on fellowship. He talked about fire squads.
Okay.
And that was a training group of four Marines, and they had the squad leader, and they would get a mission, and then they would just practice the mission over and over again. But what they did is, it's morbid in the military, but they would assume the leader would get killed. So someone else would have to take the lead.
Yep.
And they would go through it. And so the whole squad of four people would get into that leadership role.
Yep.
And to listen to those, the Navy corpsman who did something similar and the young Marine who talked about that, the way that solidified their confidence and trust, their confidence and trust of the whole unit up and down the chain was unbelievable. And I've tried to think about, you know, where is it in our organization that we can actually do that?
Yep. Yep.
But then you get back to, and it's only one idea out of a gazillion, but you get back to, how much time do we really have? And you got to do the best you can. I think managers, to your point, that they have to have foresight. They have to be able to look around corners for the organization, and they have to be really good at distilling and filtering what information needs to go to whom.
Yeah.
And you need a team that's got some willingness to allow you to not be perfect in that role. And you know, then you're just really honest, whole truth.
Right.
You know, that's the best I can do on the spot.
Yeah. No, that's awesome. Do you think, I feel like I've heard a lot of being transparent in business, you know, with your team, transparency. But there's got to be a balance, because I feel like we've tried to be maybe too transparent, and without all the other understanding, you're just saying things that people don't. Well, it's transparent. You're being transparent with them. You're telling them, but they don't have that same background knowledge to go, well, you know, kind of put two and two together as much. So then they may struggle with something because they didn't have the rest of the information or experience.
Yeah.
I feel like we've seen that, you know, even here personally.
Yep.
Because I like the, you know, the element of like, well, we can still be open and transparent about certain things, but there is an element of like, you're trusting us to lead and be doing what we're supposed to be doing, and then we're going to take care of these things, you know? And I like that.
Yeah, and describe it in such a way that it all makes sense. It all rolls up into success of the organization.
Yep.
And along the way, show what's in it for each. You know, there's got to be something in it for the person.
Yeah.
And you do what you can as an organization. You know, people accept a role for a salary. That's the first transaction.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, that's what's in it for you. But hopefully there's utility. Remember utility? Like, I can go to a Packer game probably for what? What can I hock a ticket for, $200 or less? No?
Depending on where you're sitting.
Yeah, and it's not a playoff game.
Yeah.
Or what was the average price at the Super Bowl? $6,000 or something?
Was it?
Man, it was a little bit short of $6,000. It said on TV. So that difference, you get the NFL experience, but we have utility here.
Yep.
That's what I'm talking about. So hopefully their job gets them that kind of, you know, $6,000 utility, what they're getting paid a market rate.
Right.
And if people want more, then create more margin. That means more benefits left over than when cost is. And that's back to our previous discussion, invest in yourself, constantly upgrade your skills. Then come in for Josh and say, wow, I can do this. Oh, wow, great. We can get more revenue. Oh, awesome, I can pay you more.
Right. Absolutely.
That's kind of the way it goes.
I like that. No, that's great. I want to get a little bit into that growth phase as well. You know, you've obviously worked in many businesses at a lot of different stages too. You know, when do you think a company is truly ready to scale?
Boy, that's a good question. That's a really good question. And I have to kind of bail and say it depends, because I think it really, really depends. I've scaled one company, but not to Amazon size. I've never taken anything public, so I don't have that particular experience. I have studied those cases, which isn't the same as really doing it. But we all scale on our own version, right? We want to grow the business. We want more revenue, because more revenue means more margin. More margin enables us to not only be sustainable, but to do stuff for people, grow the business, add the next bell or whistle or service.
Yep.
I think scalability has to do a lot with the market first. If you notice something in your market, an unmet need that you can validate rather than assume is really, really prevalent, you can scale it pretty dang fast. And so one thing is, you know, my cell phone's in my pocket. Yours is right there with your questions on it. And what is there now? 5 billion of those on the planet for the 8 billion people?
Yeah.
You know, that's an example of if you can come up with an app that everybody needs that they'll pay $4 for, you can go get probably $50 million in venture funding. Because what's $5 times 4 billion?
Yeah, right.
It's a big number. A
huge number.
And so I really think it's market dependent on just what the scalability in the market is. That's not the only thing. You also have to have the resources. You have to be able to get your business fit. You have to have procedures. You know, for small entrepreneurs, it's like I am. You can't be in the business if you're going to scale it, if you're going to use other people's money. And we can do that with banks. We can do that with venture. Some people do it with mom and dad, second mortgage on their house, second mortgage on their office. There's all kinds of things that you can do, right? Customer partnerships. Read my book. There's a bunch of them in there on the ways. But ultimately, if you got to make it not dependent on any one person or small group of people. What you do has to be replicatable for the market to scale.
Yeah.
And other than that, you almost have to jump in case by case. And that's, I call it magic market graph. I mean, how do you really know you're going to get sales?
Yeah.
And the thing, it's where the art of business comes in. We make assumptions. But then I invite people to attack your assumptions, because we have ChatGPT, which now, or whatever, OpenAI apps are just really nice versions of Google now. I mean, we can find out so much data, but how do we know? So attack your assumptions with research through resources like that.
Yep.
And then see if you can start to eliminate the assumption with certainty in action. Like, I know my employees can do that X more times. And the data just tells me there's an unbelievable correlation to consumer behavior if I do that. So I still have to assume if I do that, I'm going to get these sales. See what I mean? Yeah. Just try to minimize the assumptions and maximize how big the customer base. And boy, you're into a scalable deal.
So what's a big mistake then for companies that are scaling or scaled too fast where it didn't work?
Again, I talk a lot about that in my book. When people first get a credit, usually to scale, you got to use other people's money. Because you need to hire people fast. You need resources fast. You need buildings. You need assets. You need trucks. You need programmers, whatever it is.
Yep.
And it's got to be funded.
Right.
And by the nature of the business probably didn't have enough cash flow to do that. So you're going to some kind of creditor, venture, bank, mortgage on your house, whatever it is to scale what you're doing. I think what happens is people end up with that money and they feel like they got to spend it like right now. I got to push it in there. You should really challenge yourself to not spend it. Actually, let's say you got a bank loan for $1 million and your scaling idea, you kicked butt and you actually got it done. You're starting to get revenue and you spent $400,000. I would send $300,000 or $400,000 or even $600,000 back to the bank because they'll be there for you next time, especially if I've scaled enough where I'm spitting off some cash.
Right.
I just really think the cash management, what am I going to do when I'm successful with the cash?
Mm-hmm.
And what am I going to do if I have a hiccup? People don't prepare for the downside enough. And the downside, you know, we've heard of best, medium, worst case. No, do catastrophic stuff.
Right.
What would you do if? And it's a really good exercise. And I think that helps people when they scale. There's so much more.
Yeah.
Those are some, for we smaller business people, those are some good ones.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's helpful because even we are looking to, like, how do we scale from one location to the next location and essentially maybe double our business, you know, just by doing this, figuring out how we do this and then just do it somewhere else. Because there's plenty of need all over the country, you know, so we're trying to make this something that we can. But you're right in saying too that, you know, it can't be me dry. I should be able to step away and then it still is working, you know, because I won't be at the next location, or at least, you know, for full time. So it still has to work.
Yeah, you need process.
Right.
I didn't cover that enough, but you really got to figure out what your process is. And that goes back to those training modules. Have all your people work bundles. What work bundles have to happen at the next spot?
Mm-hmm.
But again, that magic market graph, how do you know you're going to get the business? You know, like the movie, if you build it, they will come. It isn't necessarily true.
Right.
You got to figure out what actual activities you need to do to drive business.
Mm-hmm.
Is it phone calls? Is it cold calls? Is it associations? Is it trade shows? You know, what is that?
Yeah. So kind of transitioning, into this workforce alignment a little bit more too.
Mm-hmm.
I do want to hit on like the work-life balance because I hear it more and more. I hear it from a lot of young people, but like I was the meeting before this podcast, I was with an owner and they were like, we need to recruit and everyone, all my employees want work-life balance, you know, and stuff like that. But, you know, at the same time, is that becoming like an excuse for lower productivity? Because I want to work less to live more, you know.
Your last comment, I think, is a truism. Work-life balance means live more, work less, and hopefully for the same dough in less time. And don't we all want that?
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, work-life balance to me is like the word leadership. It's been redefined and, you know, what exactly does it mean? And one thing I would put out there for consideration is it means something different to everybody.
Mm.
And to large companies, because they're large, have to make policy that affects many, many people. We small companies have a little bit more flexibility based on what we're getting for what we're doing. And you know, as an employer, to an extent, if I took health insurance out – and I was just looking at wages, I might be able to pull off coordinating three people working one third time for one job. But think about the logistics. And so there's that effort. So there's probably more management time. If you do any kind of appraisal work, for instance, you have three appraisals now instead of one.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but what if you have to pay health insurance to all three?
Right.
So now you have a multiplying effect. You still covered one role, and we still haven't created any more margin.
Mm-hmm.
So I get back to margin. If I have somebody who really wants work-life balance, my thought goes right to, are you creating more margin? Can you do the same amount in less time? And I've actually had employees like that where they've, you know, we actually design our weeks around a 50-hour week, which isn't very popular anymore. But we try to get people that are really jacked up about what they do. And we've had people get better results in maybe 42, 41 hours. And, you know, in that way, they've kind of got work-life balance.
Mm.
But, you know, people are getting really radical with it. Like my I have a daughter-in-law works at a Fortune 500 company, and they call it buying vacation, which and I don't know how many days, but let's say it's 3 weeks, 15 days. It essentially means I can take up to 15 more days with no pay.
Mm.
That's work-life balance, right? It's a work-life balance tactic for employees. But what happened to the role? For if you do that for your whole company, you know, you can multiply people and then divide by 52 weeks, and you can come up with the additional number of people you have to hire. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. For me, what's problematic about the whole trend is paying for it.
Right.
And having people that truly, truly do create the margin to get the extra time or the extra benefit. And that against the reality that we're in kind of a buyer's market for the employee, right? There's there's more qualified jobs than there's qualified people for. So people can be very persnickety and choosy about where they go work. And, you know, will that change with technology changes or not? It's a really difficult issue, and we want employee retention. So I had another blog recently bringing into this discussion the idea of purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the individualism comes in, is, but the corporation should have a purpose. You know, we have to make margin, but what do we do with the money when we make it? To me, that's a real good indicator of what your purpose is. Where does the margin get spent?
Yep.
And how is it partitioned? But anyway, for purpose, each person has to make decisions of what's important to them. And then they have to make trade-offs. And to have the expectation that everybody can make, you know, 200 grand or 300 grand, whatever's considered great salary now, I think those are, and do it in, you know, 10 or 15 or 20 hours a week, okay, then be creating that kind of margin. I don't want to use the word value or utility for a customer that's willing to pay you for what you do in that small amount of time to get that big money.
Right.
And so employees know that your employer has to think about that when you ask them about it. And every time you add a work-life balance benefit and you don't change anything else about your company, you're actually reducing your profitability, aren't you? You're allocating profit. And that is a reasonable thing. You know, if your company's making $1 billion and buying out vacation for 3 weeks cost $100 million, and your stockholders are still okay with $900 million in earnings, okay.
Mm.
See what I mean? Yeah. The money's got to be there to pay for the benefit. And then the alignment of the purpose of the individual has to be aligned with the organization. You can't be all things to all people, right?
Yep.
You just can't do that. So that was a bit of a drift on your question, to be sure, but it's a really complex issue.
No, it's really interesting too, just hearing you talk about it. You know, and I think like why has it gotten more popular, especially with this younger generation? And is there an element of, like, again, there's more qualified jobs and qualified people, and that ability to, like, well, if you don't, you know, aren't meeting my needs here, I'm just going to go do it somewhere else. Is that creating this, like, you know, I don't know, like, again, like that idea of, like, the work-life balance where it's just part of, like, the demands almost.
Yeah, entitlement.
Yeah.
I'm entitled because I'm awesome.
Yeah.
You know, I made $120,000 in this job, and there's a job over there. I can take $140,000 and get 2 more weeks vacation. Bye.
Right.
Now I work there for 6 months. I'm just trained, and I might do this if I were young too. I'm not sure. So I'm not really criticizing. I just think it's reality.
Yeah.
And now you have that young professional. They have a whole year of experience now. And another headhunter comes along. They work for a Fortune 500 who has an opening, and they're willing to pay $150,000 for somebody with those credentials and give them, I don't know, maybe they only get another day. They can take it by the hour. I don't know. But that cycle, I think we employers have kind of created ourselves with the labor market to create the expectation. But I don't know the answer to this. I also wonder about academia's part in this. Creating expectations in people with college degrees, you know, that's part of it. And the other thing that comes to mind that you're in the business of for sure, and that's marketing. Mm-hmm. I mean, marketing is, what is the legal real estate term? I used to have my broker's license. I think it was puffing in the state of Wisconsin. So you can exaggerate legally to a point. And that's not quite right, but you can. Oh, it's just a fabulous deck. Well, they just redid the deck. It's unbelievable. It's fabulous.
Yeah.
You know, oh my God, you're making out at that price. It's like getting that free deck, you know. Marketing portrays the transition we're going to go through and end up in for some price. And I think that's going on with work.
Mm-hmm.
I think people are using marketing to create this image of what work is. Have you ever noticed on advertisements? They're really fun to watch.
Oh, yeah.
What work is? It's people standing at terminals, you know, all the time. I mean, what are they doing?
Yeah, yeah.
Can everybody be at a terminal all the time? And what's weird is it's kind of true. A lot of us use terminals and computers in our work. But
nope.
What is work, and what are you actually shuffling around in cyberspace?
Yeah.
That AI isn't going to take over in 6 or 8 years, but it's a really interesting discussion.
I think with that too, and you know, one of the things that we even just sometimes have an issue of is, like, you know, how do we hold people accountable without it hurting morale? You know, especially, and again, like I'm taking this from a perspective of what we've seen and what we've experienced. You know, we work with a lot of companies, and we have our own team members here, you know, and our guys here are younger. They're all under 30, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, you know, how do you ride that balance between, like, we got stuff to do and get done, and it needs to get done, you know, but without getting, you know, them getting upset about it.
Yes, and it's really hard. I think it's one of the hardest things, and that's why I want to start with that whole execution idea with how do we get teams to be high-performing and optimized. Well, they have to do their stuff, right? They have to execute, and they have to be accountable. Managers have to be able to direct and know that things get done.
Mm-hmm.
One hint, I'm going to share a couple titles to books in a minute here, but one hint is to eliminate the word try.
Mm-hmm.
Try is a weasel word.
Mm.
How many times do we hear we're doing an appraisal? Well, I tried, or I'll try to get that done by Friday at 5. It's no good.
Yep.
It's a non-committed response. Boy, I'll be the first to say my organization is still struggling with that. It's very, very difficult. If you can get to the point where you get employees to make the commitment on what they're going to do, it really helps. Mm-hmm. It really, 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 really helps. And I want to share a name of a book. It's called Discipline Without Punishment.
Okay.
It's written by a person that was brought into a Frito-Lay plant a long time ago. This book has been around for years, and I wished I would have discovered it 20 years ago when he wrote it, or she wrote it. It's an unbelievable book. And they had employees taking Sharpies and writing profanities on potato chips. And this is a true story. It's unbelievable. And in the book, this person came in to fix that and talks about how they got it done. But essentially, that book is golden. I would highly recommend it to anybody. And it really does get on that idea of try. But it also comes up with a process. You need a process by which somebody doesn't get something done. Now what's going to happen? Because if there's no consequence, there, you know, the I heard first time was at industrial engineering school, but I've heard it so many times since, is you get exactly what you tolerate. So if you tolerate the slip in performance, it's going to show up again.
Yeah.
And pretty soon, as a leader, you end up at kind of lame duck might be too strong of a term, but you end up in the situation where people just go, oh, he'll forget. You know, I've been there. I mean, I've found myself in that position by not holding people accountable. And you want them as managers. We want our employees to be successful.
Yeah,
we want to give them another try. Hey, come on, you can do it. Yeah, yep. You know, yep. And then they don't.
Yep.
And you know, their predecessors did. And why isn't this happening? Well, the theory and discipline without punishment, which I really like, I don't think it's an end-all mantra, but it's a really good place to start. That is that adult professionals can make a decision. Mm. I love it. And we're working on it. I just had DWP training. I wasn't even involved. It was the transition team. We call it our operational planning committee. It's a 7-member senior management team. And they went through DWP training, and we're getting our personnel book updated to have the elements in it so we have process, and then we're going to train it out to the rest of the factory. And it doesn't mean you walk people out when they screw up. I mean, that's down the road. It's like you can decide, are you going to have 3, 4, 5, or 6 kind of discussions? And then are you going to have official reviews? And the other hint is focus on one behavior, one thing at a time.
Okay.
And get a commitment to do that one thing. But some other books, the Crucial Conversation books are really good. Crucial Conversations, you can find that. It's Audible too.
Yep.
Crucial Accountability is another one. And then there's another one. It's called The No Asshole Rule. It's really good.
Yeah.
Those are books that I think combined can answer that question in a way that you can take the concepts and really apply them to what you want to do. And that's one thing the fit professional does too. I really think you need to have a good documentation process with people.
Yeah.
And it has to be apparent of what we're trying to do. I mean, if managers continually bring back employees' ideas to will it help us execute our mission and our purpose or not, it simplifies things.
Mm-hmm.
And same thing on this. I'm asking you this. I need you to say, yes, I will.
Right.
Because it is mission critical. And it's our job as managers then to show them the business reason why
okay. They
need to do it. And then if they choose not to, you have a choice as a manager.
No, yeah, what are you going to do now?
You're going to tolerate that?
Right.
And it's so easy to talk about it, and it's so hard to do. It's really hard.
I was talking to a guy, Colin, on the tolerance aspect of, like, he said, you know, I'm going to write a book one day. It's going to say, how big's your butt? You know, yeah, and obviously it's comedic, but he's like, you know, it's the idea of, like, well, they did this, but, you know, they're good in all these other areas and something like that. And it's like, so then you tolerate it, you know. But right. How big is that butt before you're like, no, we're done now.
Yeah.
I can't tolerate this or how many times before it's unacceptable, you know. And he's like, and that's up to you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like. So I thought that was kind of interesting too, you know.
I think that's a great one. And although I'd like to say I've been perfect in this, I sure haven't. I think the times that I have been really honest about the butt.
Yep.
You know, the dead horse in the room, whatever cliche you're talking about that's not working, it makes it better ultimately.
Yeah.
And you have to lay stuff out in front of employees because if the butt's too big,
yep,
they're not going to be candidates for more responsibility.
Yep, yep.
And so that's why you talk about the big butt.
That's right. That's right. I got a couple more things here, yeah, just because I know just time-wise. But what's changing in business leadership today that companies should be paying attention to?
Well, we've hit on a couple of them, but yeah, in addition, I would say people have to figure out technology.
Okay.
And they have to figure out what that skill gap is. I really encourage people to do a lot of study on just what artificial intelligence is and yeah, understand that that's kind of the end game. That's not necessarily where you start. You know, I love ChatGPT as a writing partner.
Yep.
And a research companion works very good for me. But I think what I've learned in some postgraduate seminar courses at places like MIT and the Kellogg School of Management at Northwestern. So I like to go places where there's a lot of people working on stuff I want to find out about. And I also listened to a lecture from the chief information officer at Cisco, the food company, not the electronic company, about AI and what they're doing. And all of them say you have to just get your technology plan right first, which leads to your automation plan. And now you can collect data, because what AI is, my humble understanding, and I would, you know, please do your own research, but my understanding is it's just data analysis on steroids, massive amounts of data, massive amounts of computing power like we've never, ever had before. And so there's a temptation to really, you know, jump in. I need to do an ERP. I need to, you know, spend $1 million in staff time updating my systems, or I'll be way behind. I would say, you know, walk before you run. Take a look around, see what really works. So that's one thing that I think is going to be a challenge going forward. And then this thing about employee retention we talked about. I mean, you look around the world, NFL, the players are like carousels, college football, you know, NIL. It's like, whoa, what is a team this day and age? And way back in business school, back when I got my degrees, was they talked about Hollywood and how Hollywood would come together for a motion picture. Mm-hmm. And I've been meaning to study that, but I have a feeling that the world's going to be more like that than less like that. So, you know, right now you can go out on the internet and you can bid some engineering work.
Yeah.
And there's I don't know about hundreds, but there's a lot of people out there that will be qualified to bid on that little encapsulate of work that you have. So what is that kind of classic outsourcing versus what are you going to do inside? And then how are you going to maintain your competitive advantage? Because if you outsource everything, you don't have a competitive advantage.
Right.
Because the next guy or gal can outsource everything too. So those are a couple. Those are a couple that I think are real leadership challenges in the next 5 to 10 years.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, we were just talking to a company, again, it was today as well, where again, he's looking at us, you know, versus, you know, somebody else. And a lot of people in our industry are very much, you know, freelancers. And then they get a project and they'll put a team together and they'll grab a couple, you know, people that they know do it. And then you have this team now that goes and execute that job and then they disperse again. We didn't want that. We wanted the team and the culture and the consistency and the control of having certain expectations, you know, if we're working with someone, you know, and it could be very large company, it could be small company, but like when they're working with us and we're engaging in the business together, like I want them to have a certain expectation of we're going to deliver this and we're going to do it every single time without missing a beat. And you can't always guarantee that when it's you're outsourcing everything, You just don't have that same control. So I love the team aspect. I love the culture aspect. We're trying to create that here as much as we can,
Let me recommend another book. And the guy did a podcast with me too, Jeff Toole. It's called Mastering the Complex Sale. And what you're trying to establish, wouldn't you like to be the outsourced media department for the Fortune 500 companies?
Right. Yep.
It covers that kind of approach to business and how you can then have a team, which the customer likes because they want consistency for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. I'd really recommend taking a look at that one on that that particular role. And it's a really, I think you're going to have an advantage because, people don't go see each other anymore. I'm sitting in your studio. I drove an hour and a half to get here. I'm really glad I did. I got to meet you. But people, they want to go through the camera.
Yeah.
And it's becoming one of the top professions in the next X years is just relationship building. And it's salesmanship is a little bit off kilter because we bring in all our old bias of what that means. Mm-hmm. But the ability to relate with people, communicate with people, understand your customer's objective in a way just like you described because they understand the value of your team that you have. And I think that's an advantage going forward. And I would encourage you to keep doing it. And it's a great way to pull together your team and let everybody understand that. So when the client walks in, they feel it. Or when you walk into the client.
Yep.
And then I have very limited experience buying, and I'm not sure exactly everything your company does. Look at their website. But I know that in my world, I don't know what I'm doing. So to answer, I don't know how to buy it.
Right.
And in my mind, I have, Hollywood value editing. Mm-hmm. And I also want it to be super convenient. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the best this data point.
Yep.
But boy, once you get somebody who can do that for you that you know and they know you, it's really good. It's really, really good. I mean, you record so much content. When you're working with a customer over time, you get to know what content is there. Mm-hmm. So now they want you to dig into the B-roll.
Yeah.
And come up with a new video for whatever. And you go, oh, I remember.
Yep.
And I would think the big boys and girls, especially big companies, can really, really benefit from that. There's your plug for you.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. We're in an industry where, like, and I was just talking to another guy that's in our field, and he's in the Carolinas. He was struggling to find projects and customers. A lot of people, again, why we're coaching people in our industry specifically, is because we're doing something that they want to get to someday. And they're like, how are you guys going out and getting the clients? Well, we're not waiting for people to come to us. Why? Because there's still not enough of an understanding of video and what we do to where a company like you guys would go, oh, we have this problem. We should probably call the local videographer. Like, no one does that. No one's doing that. But we're going out, being proactive in our sales outreach to create those opportunities to go, hey, we got something here that I'm sure you haven't considered yet before. And I know that you have similar problems to these guys because we've already worked with them. Here's something to consider. Creating this video with a plan on how to use it and this understanding, and then the light bulb kind of goes off like, wow, never really thought about that before as a viable solution to whatever issue it was. And then next thing you know, you're working together. But people don't know, so they don't come to you, kind of thing. But yeah, the industry is going to be exciting because the video is just getting more and more popular.
Yeah.
How we consume. We talked to a big manufacturer. He said, post-COVID, nobody wants to tour here anymore. He's like, there'll be a handful of guys, but everyone just wants to see a shop tour and, you know, video on our business because they don't want to fly out here anymore. You know, it's these kinds of things that just, it's just changing how people do business, how we interact, how we communicate.
Yeah. And again, therein lies, I think, some opportunity, the people that actually get on the airplanes and can correlate when the customer has the problem and you have the solution, boom, fly on the water.
Yep.
Set the hook, baby.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know.
Now we do a lot of virtual selling right now, but whenever somebody gives us the opportunity to come out, meet them, shake their hand and tour, like we're on it, you know,
nice.
Why not? You know, it's like that for sure makes you stand out because there's plenty of people out there that still do business and appreciate that,
mm-hmm.
you know, and why would I not take that step if we know that they're interested?
Yep.
You know, I like that. Couple just last questions here, you know, as we kind of wrap things up, what's one of the biggest lessons that you've learned in just taken away in your 40 plus years of business? I say one of the biggest because it doesn't have to be.
Yeah, there's, biggest,
there's a lot. Yeah.
It's kind of what comes to mind on a day like today. And because there is so many, and there, again, you got to throw out, it depends on the circumstance, but I really think a bias toward action. I mean, I'm an industrial engineer. I love data. I get way into it, but I've caught myself, okay, that's way too much analysis. It's time to do something. And you're never, I have a saying up on my cork board, my office. It was from a professional female cyclist. And it says, if you wait for perfect conditions, you're never going to get anything done. Mm. And I think that is, I can bring that into almost everything that's happened to me in business. And if people take it for granted. Isn't it weird? We hear these things. You know, I'm not the first guy to say that at all. But how many of us actually do something about it? You know, how many,
right.
you know, we threw out a couple book titles. What is it? 1% of your listeners are actually going to go get those books. Come on.
Yep.
Come on, listeners, go pick up those books if you have those problems. But most of us, we get into our routine and we have all these things pulling at us. And so you really want to get that done. And that's a corollary to stay focused. Mm. I had a buddy, there's three of us, we got our master's degrees and we had a party. And this guy, we're just drinking beer and he says, you got to do one thing and do it good. You know, he's a super articulate guy. He's a doctor. And, you know, when I wandered into real estate, that wasn't doing one thing and doing it really good. That was too far removed.
Yep.
For me to invest my dollars in compared to what I was good at. So focus combined with a bias toward action, I think, is what I would leave the listener with. That's not just all of it, but those are good ones.
That's a really good one. Now, the action, that stops so many people all the time. The action, that would kind of be an answer to this next piece too, but... if you had one more piece of advice specifically for an owner that was struggling to maybe take their company to the next level, what would you say to them?
I get your business fit. What does that mean? What is a fit business? Well, the business owner's got to figure that out. But one thing that when you're going to take something to the next level, you should be able to pull together financial statements that reflect what's going on in the business. In a very short, the key one is the income statement, is the engine for business. Uh-huh. Certainly, your behavior impacts other statements, to be sure. But you should, that's where we have our gross margin. That is the only place the gross margin is. So what are you doing to create gross margin?
Yeah.
And with that one, so that's a plethora, kind of that's a big statement. But in that, we have the selling, general, and administrative. So the non-factory, the non-studio time, all that support stuff. I challenge listeners, and you can get more on this in my book too. I believe SG&A is largely discretionary. What does that mean? I have it because it's nice. Yeah, you know, I picked this finish. I picked these chairs. Could have I saved? $300 in here on these chairs,
yeah,
and not had any difference. I don't know that because, you know, that's a different thing. Utility matters. Brand matters. Mm-hmm. When we walk into an office, there are organizations, service industries, where you can't be in a warehouse. You have to have the mahogany table or whatever it is. But work to make sure that all of those actions and expenditures, you can show how it generates profitable revenue or lowers cost.
Yep.
And if you can't, that owner you just talked about should stop doing it. And mm-hmm. and I love this analogy. I'll just leave you with this one analogy. And you're a small entrepreneur. You're going to do a side hustle. You do not want to borrow any money. You don't want to go in savings. You don't want to second mortgage your house. In my book, I say, look over at your living room shelf. What is everything on that shelf worth on eBay? Mm. And you're going, okay, come on. You know what, $20 in the hassle? Maybe I have grandpa's antique I'll get $50 for. But take it, if you have a business, what's in your warehouse?
Yeah.
What's in your storeroom? What's in the closet? What vehicle aren't you using? You know, if it's your whole property, you know, the kids are at college. We still have the swing set. It's going to be 15 years before grandkids get here, I think, right? Maybe I can get $1,000 for that mm-hmm. or 500, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And all of a sudden you do some of that and you end up with some money.
Right.
So that concept in your business, what are the idle, for that owner you just talked about, what are the idle assets that just aren't doing it for you yet that maybe you can buy it again? You don't, well, I'm going to need it later. Well, sell it and then buy it then. Mm-hmm. It's very easy to say, it's very difficult to do because we get emotionally attached to our SG&A, all the stuff in our office. You know,
yep.
our look and our feel, but yep. what is it really? I mean, what is it really? If you're a construction company and you have a fleet of awesome pickup trucks for your project managers, do they really need 2,500 GMCs with dualies on the back?
Yeah.
Or would they be perfectly fine in the Colorado version of that pickup?
Yeah.
You know, it's like that. It's Absolutely. Stuff like that.
No, I like that a lot.
Yeah.
Well, Paul, I want to thank you again. This has been awesome. I also want to give you a chance. Like, where can people connect with you?
Yep.
Where can they find more information about you?
Yeah.
Things like that.
Thank you. So first thing is love it if you'd check me out and subscribe to my weekly message called the Margin Max Minute. You can find it on any podcast channel and YouTube. And then that is a short version. It's 5 or 10 minutes. I give you one thing to implement next week that's going to make a difference. That's mm-hmm. my goal. The other product I do is a podcast. That's usually between 45 minutes and 2 hours. In there, I work to have a guest and we do a deep dive on a subject. So please go out and look at that. That's called the Fit Professional One podcast. And again, you can find those on all the channels. My website is thefitprofessional1.com, so that's the number one at the end. That will be updated. You can go on there. You can find my blogs. I'm also on LinkedIn mm-hmm. Under the Fit Professional One and Paul Ayers. You can follow me at either one.
Yeah.
So those are great places. And if you want to send me an email, just go on my website and fill out the form and I'll respond. That's the best way to get in touch with me probably. Or on LinkedIn, occasionally I'll see a direct message, but there's so many.
Yeah.
It's better to go on the website and just say, hey, I want to talk about something. Let's talk. Right. And I do offer a complimentary discovery session to clients so they can get to know me a little bit. Mm-hmm. And again, about July, you'll start to see some giveaways that are highly valuable and some really low dollar items so they can start to see the way I do business and see if that fits their problems. And then they can decide if they want to go to more expensive alternatives. I do want to just announce, I am really excited about my mastermind and my elite level masterminds coming up. the elite level mastermind, I'm going to start with that optimizing employees, optimizing your teams. Mm-hmm. It's going to be eight session in person. It's going to be a Minneapolis venue, probably a Phoenix venue. I'll have at least five speakers. The speakers I've lined up that are interested already are outstanding.
Nice.
And when you come out of that session, those participants will really have a good feel of what they're going to do. It's affordable, and but it'll be high impact. I always gauge my products for people to get at least 10x margin produced on what they're doing. And if they can't quite do that math, I'll sure help them with the math. But those spots will be limited, so keep an eye out for those starting about July. I anticipate having those filled by roughly Thanksgiving of 2025 for a 2026 start. And then we'll introduce more cohorts over time. So stay tuned if you miss them.
Yeah.
But yeah.
That's exciting.
Really excited about it.
Well, great. Hey, I appreciate you so much for coming in, taking the time. This was great. I learned a lot, and just excited for the future. So
super. Good luck to you, too. Hope your new studio rocks, and good luck with those corporate clients. Get after them.
That's right.
All right.
Well, thanks again, Paul.
Thank you.
And as always, guys, thank you so much for listening today. We're excited to be in the new podcast. We're excited to kick off this week with Paul Ayres. We're going to be bringing a lot of new people in, some really cool topics. And remember to subscribe. We're on Apple, Spotify, and the video's on YouTube. So we look forward to the next one.